Hello, and welcome to episode number 32 of The Music Plays the Band on the Pantheon Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Koritz of the Dark Star Orchestra. I hope you all are safe and well. Well, we're still on the road as I start this, but I was able to finish it up in St. Louis as I'm home for a couple of days in the middle of this run. Even though it's only for two nights, it's still great to come home and see the family for just a minute. We've had a great tour so far, and it should be over right now. But we're going back out to make up our New Year's run this weekend. So it'll be New Year's Eve, April Fool's kind of thing. Then it's home for another couple days before we fly out to L.A. to do one night at the Skull and Roses Festival. And after that, we get a good month off before hitting the Southeast and making our way up to the Dark Star Jubilee in Ohio over Memorial Day weekend. As fun as the tour has been, though, I guess our big news is about Europe. That's right, we are very excited to be going to Europe in September to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Grateful Dead's Europe 72 tour. We had wanted to match up the dates and do the tour this spring, but the timing wasn't quite right, but we will be able to recreate a few of the shows in the very same rooms that they were originally performed in. We've played in Europe on many occasions, but never on a tour this extensive. We're going to be hitting England, France, Germany, and Italy, so super, super excited about that. I'm also very excited to bring along as my guest today Grammy-winning harmonica virtuoso Howard Levy. Howard might be best known to many of you as a member of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones, but he's also recorded with Paul Simon, Donald Fagen, Dolly Parton, and a host of others. He's a fan of the Dead, and their paths crossed many times over the years, and he has some great stories to share. Also joining me today is Patrick Higgins from Last Fair Deal out of the Hampton Roads area in Virginia. So as always, I'm glad you're here, and before we get to the first segment, I humbly ask you to support the podcast any way you can. There's the monthly Patreon subscription with giving levels starting as low as $5 a month, which gives you exclusive bonus content, including outtakes, expanded interviews and segments, videos and stories from the road, and much, much more. You can also make a one-time contribution through PayPal, and a portion of all proceeds goes to the Rex Foundation, the charity started by the Grateful Dead. You can find out about all of this and more at www.themusicplaystheband.net. And wherever you are listening to the podcast, please rate, like, and review. So let's get right to it. Here we go. The Black Music Moment is brought to you by The Queen Store, brandingandapparel.com for all your branding and apparel needs. Technology-driven solutions and concierge service for managing programs of all sizes. The Black Music Moment is our attempt at chronicling the profound influence of black music and musicians on the Grateful Dead. Today we honor Smokey Robinson. William Smokey Robinson Jr. was born on February 19, 1940 in Motown, Detroit, Michigan. He was always interested in music and started his first doo-wop group, the Five Chimes, while he was still in high school. They soon changed their name to the Matadors, started playing all over Detroit, and eventually settled upon the name the Miracles. In 1957, he met songwriter Berry Gordy, who was impressed not only with Smokey's voice, but the 100-plus songs he had already written. Soon after, Gordy founded Tamla Records, which later became Motown, and Smokey and the Miracles were one of the first acts that they signed. In late 1960, the group recorded their first hit single, Shop Around, which became Motown's first million-selling hit record. Between 1960 and 70, Robinson would produce 26 top 40 hits for the Miracles as lead singer, chief songwriter, and producer, including hits such as You've Really Got a Hold on Me, The Tears of a Clown, Track of My Tears, Ooh Baby Baby, and the one we will hear today, I Second That Emotion, the group's only number one hit during those years. Robinson was also one of the major songwriters and producers for the label, composing hits for many Motown artists, including the Temptations hits My Girl, Get Ready, and another one that was covered by Jerry Garcia, The Way You Do the Things You Do. In addition to all of this, he was also named as Motown's vice president. In 1969, Smokey retired from the road, but that was short-lived. He embarked on a steady solo career in the 70s and topped the charts again in 1981 with the hit Being With You. Smokey's a legend in the game and is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and he's received multiple Lifetime Achievement Awards. He will definitely go down in history as one of the greatest songwriters of his generation. Second, that emotion was performed a handful of times by the Grateful Dead in 1971, and the song was a regular part of the Jerry Garcia Band's repertoire between 1973 and 1994. But here is Smokey Robinson and the Miracles with the original 1967 hit, I Second That Emotion. I'd like to take a minute and tell you about Beth Koritz. She is a psychotherapist, intuitive clarity coach, and founder of the Authenticity Academy. For the past 12 years, she has been supporting her clients to fully embody their authenticity and create the life they desire with her three-step clarity coaching program. This is your time to gain clarity, defining yourself by who you really are and not what you do. Increase your confidence by activating your inner powers and take soul-led action, creating a life in alignment with your purpose, passion, and desires. Are you ready to learn more? Then book a free 30-minute clarity call with Beth Koritz. Visit www.yourclarity.coach or the sponsor page of the musicplaystheband.net. I know she is looking forward to supporting you on your journey. In today's segment of There Is a Grateful Dead Cover Band in Every Town, we're heading back out to Virginia to speak with Patrick Higgins of Last Fair Deal. Okay, good morning. I am here today with Patrick Higgins from Last Fair Deal, who's based, I guess, out of the Hampton Roads area down in Virginia Beach, that area.
Yes, sir.
How are you today?
I live in Norfolk, others in Virginia Beach and Portsmouth, but they're all cities all kind of together, you know, they all bump up against each other.
Right on, man. Well, thank you for being here. Why don't you
thank you.
Go ahead and tell us Last Fair Deal down in that area. How'd it come together? A little rundown on your history and how you got started.
Well, how it got started, I was one of the sort of original members, but I did not start the band. One of our drummers, our Mickey guy, Dave Perkins, would have these regular, you know, weekly jams or semi-weekly jams at his house and had lots of people come over. And one of the regulars was our Jerry guy, Kyle Folsom. And he would come over there and jam a lot. All kinds of people would come over. And so the story I got was Kyle had a gig at a local place lined up, and then his band sort of dissolved or was not able to play for a while. So between he and Dave, I guess I said, hey, why don't we work up a bunch of Grateful Dead stuff and just kind of go jam all these Dead songs for a night, you know, all the hippies will come out and, you know, it would just be fun. And so they started working up some songs. Then I guess after a few sessions, something was kind of missing. I guess that they needed another guitar player. And then after we did the show, it was kind of like, hey, that was really fun. And, you know, some people started calling, hey, can you come do this party? Can you come play at this club? You know, sort of started getting offers, and we sort of fell back in, you know, just sort of, hey, well, we all do other stuff, but let's keep doing this too. And, you know, over the years, some personnel changes, people come and go, people go and come back, you know, we've got the solid lineup, close to the original lineup we've had now for a number of years.
And how long have you all been together?
10 years about, 10 years. A little over 10 years. Yeah.
And your full instrumentation, your full seven piece, right?
We are. Yes.
That's
nice. We favor, you know, sort of the 70s lineup with Adana, but, you know, we all play the roles similar to you guys. But we will still do 80, you know, we'll do the later material as well.
And I know, I mean, you'll cover all parts of it, because I saw a video of you all doing Chinatown Shuffle. So you're going back to the 60s stuff as well.
Yeah, we'll go way back. Our girl singer, Sherry Lynn, she really, really likes Pigpen. So we, and our keyboard player doesn't really sing Pigpen stuff, you know, like that. We don't really have a person that can do Pig well. So Sherry takes them and she makes them her own, man. And she does just a great job.
Do you all take a specific approach when you're interpreting and performing it, or do you just go for it? You try and keep it true to the form. What's your approach?
I'm the Bobby guy. I tend to stick very closely to what Bob does. And I got to see the Grateful Dead. Now our age range in the band is like mid late 30s to 60. So some people didn't get to see them, but there's, you know, this stuff is so well documented.
Right.
You know, people see videos and all that. So what we really try and concentrate on is the vocals. We really want our vocals to be right. We like the heart. You know, a lot of folks say, oh, Grateful Dead, oh, they sang like it. Well, they didn't. Those guys were good. They had good vocals. They had, and really creative harmonies too.
Right.
And quirky. And we try and dig into that quirkiness. And so, you know, we really put an emphasis on the vocals. And then musically, we like to get the body of the song correct and certain signature things that happen during jams. We use the jams a little bit more to launch into expressing ourselves, you know, still sounding Grateful Dead, Grateful Dead-ish. Yet using that to, you know, explore. But the bodies of the songs we like to keep pretty true to form. Occasionally we'll do a specific set list if it's like we're celebrating something. Usually we'll kind of come up with our own, but we like to make them look like a Grateful Dead set.
Right.
List.
How often are y'all playing?
Oh, 2 to 4 times a month right now. We're trying to expand, become a little more of a regional act. The idea is to play, you know, 2 to 4 times, but not in the same area.
So where all have you been going to?
Here we play in the Outer Banks, up near Williamsburg, Richmond, a little further west of Richmond. We play, our sort of home base here is a place called Elevation 27, and that's one of the owners there is Bill Reed. You may have been familiar with him way back. And he's kind of taken a liking to us, kind of try and help us get further afield.
That whole area down there, I mean, we come to Norfolk quite a bit, and there's a lot of bands in that region. But Hampton in particular is a favorite stomping grounds for the Dead, you know.
Norfolk. Of course.
They played a couple of legendary shows there, some big bust outs down there. So obviously the scene is really strong down there. What can you tell me a little bit about your local scene?
Well, I'll tell you, the local scene as far as Dead, there's not a lot of Grateful Dead acts down here. Richmond and D.C. have tripled in the number. I mean, they just exploded in those areas. There's really just a couple of us down here doing it. There's some people doing some acoustic-based things down here, too. But there's a lot of deadheads, a lot of hippies. The beach is a great place to be a hippie.
Right.
I moved down here in, like, 2001. And to me, this area is about as similar to the West Coast as I found in the East.
What for you, what is it about? I mean, there's a whole community that comes and sees you, I'm sure, and you see a lot of the same fans. And what is it about this music that creates this community, this subculture, if you will, in your mind?
You know, I guess some of it, you know, Dead & Company and all that has really raised their profile. I think a lot of people just kind of in it. Well, we can remember back in the day when kids started showing up for the party. They heard it was the best party in town. But still, in that set of people, there's some that it just resonates with. I would like to think it's the depth in the lyrical content of the songs that just, it just moves you in a subconscious, archetypical way. It just, it's in our DNA almost. Plus, you know, the heart of the music is so much, is American, is Americana. You know, yeah, Bob and Jerry, they are so into folk, bluegrass, jazz, this, that. But it's all fountains from the same well that I think just touches our hearts.
Before I let you go, you mentioned Bob Weir and all that, and you told me you have another side project that's Bob Weir related. You want to share a little bit about that?
This I started some years ago. There's, as you know, tons of Grateful Dead tribute bands, lots of Jerry tribute bands. Jerry gets his due, deservedly so. I've always been kind of the Bob Weir guy. So I just kind of felt he was overlooked a little bit, you know. Now, and there's not as many hardcore Bob fans as Jerry fans, but so I started this this band called Getting Weird with an apostrophe D, and we call it a tribute to Bob Weir's musical legacy. So we don't emulate any particular lineup, and some stuff we try and do very true to either the record or live performance. Other stuff we'll make a little more interpretive. We're just trying to just expose some of his genius to people. I think he's brilliant.
Are you going outside the Grateful Dead catalog then and pulling up Easy to Slip and Shades of Grey and all that kind of stuff?
It's funny you should mention that. Yeah, extensively. We do a lot of stuff from Bobby and the Midnights, Rat Dog. This weekend, we were working on Easy to Slip, Heaven Help the Fool, and Salt Lake City.
Come on.
We do stuff off his Blue Mountain album. And we go back. Of course, we mine the Grateful Dead catalog, you know, because people want to hear Grateful Dead songs, too. And I want to keep playing them. So.
Sure. But it's great that you're bringing out a bunch of those Bobby tunes that not many people play, that not some, to be honest, that some Dead fans might not even know about.
Some of them don't. We've played Two Gin a number of times and people are like, I never heard that. Are you sure that's a Bobby song? I'm sure it's a Bobby song.
I think it's great you're doing that, and I think it's great
keeping it
all alive down in that area with Last Fair Deal as well. And I appreciate you taking the time this morning. It took us a few minutes to find a time that worked for both of us with me traveling, and you know you did a little traveling. But again, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I really appreciate you taking the time this morning.
It's a pleasure and an honor, Rob. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. That's Patrick Higgins from Last Fair Deal out of Hampton Roads, Virginia. If you like what you're hearing today, please consider supporting the podcast with a contribution. We have two ways for you to do this. You can become a patron with a monthly subscription for as little as $5 a month. That includes expanded video versions of our segments, all of the outtakes that don't make it onto the podcast, videos from home and on the road, and much, much more. You can also make a one-time contribution via PayPal, and part of every contribution goes to the Rex Foundation. You can do this and learn more about the podcast at our website, www.themusicplaystheband.net. And if you have the time, please like, rate, and review the podcast on whatever player you might use. Thanks for your continued support and for helping spread the word about the podcast. Our feature conversation is brought to you by Grateful Sweats. Grateful Sweats' subtle song designs will strike a chord for heads who get it. Search Grateful Sweats on Etsy for a wide selection of cold weather gear like hoodies, beanies, and of course sweatpants, as well as other Grateful goodies with more than 30 designs, like Tennessee Jed, Women Are Smarter, and my personal favorite, Eyes of the World. Visit Etsy.com/shop/GratefulSweats, or get there from the sponsors page at our website. And right now, if you use the code THEMUSICPLAYS, you can save 10% and receive a free pin. And don't miss the clearance section with items up to 80% off. So as soon as you're done listening, head on over to Grateful Sweats. My featured guest today is two-time Grammy winner Howard Levy. Howard is best known as a harmonica player, most notably with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, but he plays numerous instruments, has toured with many legends and has appeared literally on hundreds of albums. His love for the Dead goes way back, and he shared some pretty amazing stories. This quickly goes down as one of my favorite conversations so far, and I really hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed being a part of it. So here is Howard Levy. Okay, good day, everybody. I am here today with harmonicist Howard Levy. How are you, sir?
I'm just fine. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to meet you, and I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Sure.
I know you're kind of back out there working again. Were you able to stay busy during the pandemic?
Well, actually, I've been extremely busy through a combination of, I have an online harmonica school with a company called Artist Works, and that has actually grown quite a bit. And just doing a bunch of live streams. My wife and I did a whole series of them that we, the first one we did, we gave all the money that people sent in to the Greater Chicago Food Depository.
Nice.
That was like right in the, at the worst part of the pandemic in late 2020. And I've been recording a lot of tracks for like albums that I'm making on my own, and also for many other artists, maybe 50. I can't, I've lost track, like a lot. So I've actually honed my home recording skills quite a bit.
That's fantastic. And being able to, with the technology today, to be able to keep working during all this is just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been a journey. And I also got the virus right in the beginning of it. I was extremely sick, but managed to avoid going to the hospital, and I recovered fully, but it was very scary.
Wow.
And I don't want to really talk about it much, but it was, it made me extremely, and my wife got it after I got it, a milder case of it. It made me extremely cautious about getting out there and playing again.
For sure.
But I'm going to start doing that actually in May.
With in Chicago, or are you going on the road?
Well, I'm just going to start with some baby steps playing around here. And then I have other gigs that are road gigs in August, September, October, things starting back up. And maybe sooner, maybe some things during the summer as well. I just hope the virus cooperates.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. You know, we're back out there, and we started a couple months ago, very cautiously, and waiting to see, will we be able to continue, or is the shoe going to drop on the other side, you know?
Yep.
Hopefully everything will be good, because right now it's really good to be getting back out. If you don't mind, before we really get into the Dead, I'd like to start back at the beginning with you. I know you were born in Brooklyn. Can you give us just a brief story on your musical upbringing and how you got started on your journey?
Sure. Well, as you said, I was born in New York City in Brooklyn, and I was just always fascinated by music, and there was a lot of it in the house. My dad sang like Broadway stuff and opera, and had a tried to have a career when he was young, after he got back from World War II, and had some moderate success, but never enough to really make any real money at it. I'll just put it that way. And then he went into business. And my mom went to what was called the High School of Music and Art back then, which is the High School of New York, High School of Performing Arts. And so they were really into music and art, and so there was always music playing in the house, and they had parties where friends would come over and they'd gather around the piano and people would sing and play instruments. And, you know, I didn't know that was unusual. So it was just something that music seemed like very natural to me. And I started playing piano. I finally got them to agree to give me piano lessons when I was about 8.5 years old. And I immediately started improvising. So I guess I had been like listening to stuff and had that desire inside me. And then I ended up going to the Manhattan School of Music for piano and theory every Saturday for 4 years from age 9 to 12. But I just kept improvising. Like anything I heard that I liked, I would imitate it, you know, whatever style of music it was. And then after my strong classical music period, I started listening to the radio more, and you know, listening to all the stuff the wide variety of stuff that was played on so-called hit radio back then, which included everything. You know, you'd hear Jimi Hendrix and Ramsey Lewis and Burt Kampfert, you know, like these goofy instrumental tunes, novelty songs like They're Coming to Take Me Away and all sorts of really weird things that were on so-called hit radio. So I listened to everything. And then when I was a teenager, I got turned on to blues. And I first heard the great Chicago blues harmonica players. And I was playing piano before that, you know. And this blew my mind. And that's what led to me picking up the harmonica. I'm trying to make the story short. It's a long
You're doing
story.
Great. I'm actually going to back up and ask you a question about that. When you were, you know, you're knee deep in the classical thing, how did the teachers, the instructors there react to this kid who just wanted to improvise and was listening to music outside the classical realm? Were they cool with that, or was that a no-no?
Oh yeah, they actually were. I was one of the few kids at Manhattan who improvised, and there were tons of kids who played great, but not too many composers or improvisers. And sometimes I was really lazy about reading music. And so if I heard someone else play a piece, because they had these little student concerts all the time, and my teacher assigned me the piece, I would kind of remember how it went. So if I got to a part where it was hard to see, I go, I think it kind of goes like this. And I understood harmony. And so I would play stuff that it wasn't what was on the page, but it didn't sound wrong. It drove my teacher crazy. Because I was just like, I think it goes like this, you know. So it drove her nuts, but she understood, and the school understood. So sometimes I got to play my original things in concerts. And they actually recommended that I study in Paris with Nadia Boulanger when I was 11 years old. And she's probably the most famous music teacher of the mid-20th century. She taught Leonard Bernstein and all sorts of other really great musicians, like Berto Gismonti, the great Brazilian guitarist and composer. And I didn't know who the hell she was. And my parents are going like, we can't move to France for 6 months. I mean, and I agreed. I said, how could I do that? You know, I'd miss my friends. But anyway, so the school definitely understood that my natural ability was something that was substantial, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, when you have something like that, it's just a matter of how hard are you willing to work at it to, instead of being like a flash in the pan, like, oh yeah, he's so talented, you know, this kind of thing. And how hard are you willing to work? And do you really want to do it as a profession? You know, do you want to be a professional musician? And how does that work to be a professional musician? And so these are things I kind of wrestled with. After I got into blues, I discovered jazz, and actually John Coltrane is what was my initial exposure to jazz, was listening to a Coltrane album and having it blow my mind.
Right.
So I didn't start out like, first you listen to the older stuff, and no, you listen, whatever grabs you, you know, pulls you into that universe. And so, and then I would go out to every club that I could in New York City to hear all the greatest jazz musicians. And they didn't care if I wasn't old enough to drink. They would let me in anyway, you know, right. And say, drink a Coke and sit here at the Village Vanguard or the Gate or wherever I went. And around the same time, I was also going out to what was then called the Village Theater and later became the Fillmore East, and listening to all the great rock. I mean, it's so hard to even call it rock. I mean, like musical acts that came through New York City, which were, you know, everybody.
Right.
And that's where I first heard the Dead, actually.
You started to allude to it, and I kind of cut you off and made you back up. I apologize. So, but you're so accomplished as a keyboard player, and you heard the Chicago Bluesman, and that's what drew you in. Can you tell me a little bit more about just all of a sudden this awakening to the harp?
Well, yeah, because growing up in New York, New York's not exactly a blues capital.
You know? Right.
But blues is in all American music, and every American person who lives and breathes hears it and absorbs it to a certain extent. And so when I heard these guys, It was so kind of a combination of like primal and at the same time, there was a lot of sophistication to it too. It was surprising. And just the sound of the harmonica was something like, oh man, listen to that. I thought the harmonica was like a little kid toy. I had no idea anyone could make a sound like that on it. And as a piano player, it was very appealing to me because, you know, with a piano, you have to go to it. And it weighs up like 900 right. pounds, and you have to like make sure that you know you can get into a room that nobody else is playing it. And you know, the harmonica you can put in your pocket and take it with you anywhere. It's kind of subversive in a way. One of my buddies in high school taught himself how to play really well inside of a few months, and I thought, well, he was the drummer in the little band we had. A drummer can teach us.
I knew that was coming, man.
Surely I could do this. So, the first thing that happened is we went out to hear some blues at a club called the Cafe Agogo on McDougal Street. This is a long story, but I'll make it short. And it was a double bill of James Cotton and Paul Butterfield at their height, both of them. Their greatest bands, and this absolutely blew my mind. And I said, I gotta learn how to play the blues. And you know, I figured out all sorts of stuff on piano, and then it was like maybe I could even play the harmonica, you know, and carry this thing around and sound like that. So I was like, I guess I was 18 when I bought my first harp, or 17, I don't remember. That's how that started, and then. But like I said, at the same time, like right after that is when I got into jazz. And so like these two things were going together in my mind, and I wasn't really paying that much attention to classical music anymore.
As you're starting out on that harp, who are like, are there enough harp players out there to be an influence? I really don't know.
Oh yeah. No, the guys that I was influenced by were the great Chicago blues players. It was Little Walter and Junior Wells and Paul Butterfield. He was my personal favorite. James Cotton, and I would listen to that stuff. And, you know, my friends, we had this band that was, we were playing blues, you know, and we actually had a harmonica player who was a professional harp player. And so I got to hear him play. And I was very inspired, and I couldn't play a lick on the harmonica until I got out to Northwestern. You know, it was freshman orientation week, and I had been carrying this harp in my pocket, and not this one, but very similar to it, and honking away, and then, okay, I'll tell the story.
thank you.
I went to a rally for the Chicago Seven. Do you know who that is?
Of course.
Okay. And they let them out of prison so that they could make these speeches and raise funds for their defense.
Right.
And it was quite an experience. I didn't know a soul there. And there were about 500 of us packed into this little lecture hall in Northwestern. And they were all the guys were there, like Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and Randy Davis and David Dellinger and Tom Hayden. And they were all making speeches. It was really a mind blower. And I had been pretty actively involved in the peace movement in New York and marched in the big peace anti-war demonstrations against the Vietnam War. And so I was very passionate about this. And I walked out of there not knowing a soul. And I was like, okay, what do I do with myself now? That blew my mind. So, well, maybe I'll try to play the harmonica again. And I had this G harp that I had bought at Manny's on West 48th Street for $2.25. And I picked it up, and suddenly I could bend a note. And I started playing all these blues licks because I knew how they were supposed to sound. And within a half hour, I was playing all sorts of stuff. And it was like, you know, the first day of the rest of my life. That's how that started. Before I had taken one class, it was freshman orientation week. This was a very exciting time. And soon after playing the harp and just like obsessively hours and hours each day, any place I could find that had good acoustics, hallways, bathrooms, wherever, you know, I realized that there were a bunch of notes missing. And this was when I discovered, I just figured that it was, since it was a musical instrument, it had to have all the notes on it.
Right.
That's why I was never any good at math. I was constantly making illogical assumptions. So I figured out how to get those missing notes by certain techniques that I stumbled upon just mathematically, saying, well, you can bend the draw notes on the bottom, you can bend the blow notes on top. What happens if I try to bend the blow notes on the bottom? Maybe something will happen. And so one day, another note popped up, a higher note, and it was one of the notes that was missing. And I discovered that all six notes that are missing from the chromatic scale that you can't get by blowing, drawing, or bending, attainable by this method. And I had never heard any of my harmonica heroes play any of these notes on any recordings. And so I can't believe that I'm the first one to do this. I'm 18 years old. I'm a college student. I just started playing harmonica 3 months ago. Well, I guess I'll just go for it, and I don't know what to call it. So I talked to a friend of mine who I was playing with in the jazz band, saxophone player. I said, what is it when you blow a note a little harder and this higher note pops out? He said, it sounds like you're overblowing a harmonic. I said, okay, that's not what it is at all. But I called it overblowing. And sorry, I did. I mean, it's a very inaccurate term.
If you were going to rename it now, what would you call it?
Ooh. I'll get back to you later. I have no idea.
Wow, I'm surprised.
Note extraction? I don't know. I mean, well, people call it overbending sometimes.
This is groundbreaking stuff at that point. I mean, no one's really done this and discovered this.
Yeah, there's one recording of one guy playing, squeaking out one note in 1931, and there were a few people who squeaked out a few notes on recordings in the 60s. And there was one guy who was really trying it for a while, and he gave up. But I'm the first one to take it and run with it. And it was not a generally known thing among harmonica players at all.
And musically, that had to open up a whole new world musically.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I see the harmonica in my mind as a piano keyboard. And so I unlike most guys playing a diatonic harmonica, I'm thinking about what notes I'm playing instead of like three draw, four blow. I'm thinking, you know, B and C, and a four draw bend is a C sharp or a D flat. You know, I'm thinking notes, direct one-to-one correspondence with the keyboard. And so, it's because of who I was as a natural improviser, composer, and pianist that I would see the harmonica this way, you know? So that's how it happened. And I was 18 years old.
Back to the Fillmore East.
Yeah.
That's where you start seeing all the music of the day. You're still, so this is in high school. This is before you leave for college. And that's where you first saw the Grateful Dead.
Yeah. It was called the Village Theater at that time. And, the Fillmore East, was actually a former Yiddish theater on Second Avenue. And, was it Fifth Street? Between 5th and 6th, maybe, on the Lower East Side of New York. It was like part of a Ukrainian neighborhood. It was right around there. And there were some Jewish delis on 2nd Avenue. I mean, it was like an old New York, you know? And my friend, the same guy who turned me on to the harmonica and blues, also had this Grateful Dead album, their first one. It was probably just called The Grateful Dead, I think. Mm-hmm. And it had Morning Dew on it and all sorts of tunes like that. And, he said, yeah, this band is really great. Let's go hear them. And so, you know, the three of us, I think, the flute player in the band and me and the drummer, went down to the Village Theater and paid whatever the hell it was. And there was probably an opening act. I don't remember. But the Dead came out on stage, and they immediately sounded great. And Pigpen was in the band then. It was that incarnation, you know, 67, maybe?
Yes, sure. It could be.
I think I was 16, maybe, or 17, 67 or 68. Don't remember.
While you're talking, I'm going to look it up.
Oh, okay. Oh, you'd see. Because when I met Jerry years later, I told him that I was at that gig. And he was, oh, wow, really? Yeah, he had a few things to say about it, about what the band was like back then. Oh, my goodness.
67.
Was that right?
The Village I'm looking. Theater? Let's see.
It's my recollection.
December 27th or December 26th, maybe, Village Theater, New York, 1226 and 12/27/67.
Wow.
Apparently there was a band called Take Five that also played.
I don't remember.
And believe it or not, this is one of the few shows. Well, back then it was hard for them to get them, but there's no set list in here for that. But some of those early 60s shows, where they were hard to document set lists. But that was it. So it was right around Christmas time, 1967.
Okay. Well, I was right. There you go, how do you man. Like that? So I was, I had just turned 17, maybe. I don't know. I can't add anymore. So I was born in 51. So I was 16. I was 16 and a half. Yeah. So I was
birthday. So you haven't picked up the harp yet, have you?
No. Oh, no, not at all. So Pigpen probably played some harp back then.
Oh, yeah. What was your impression as you get into the harp and you look back on the day? What was your impression of Pigpen as a harp player?
I don't remember anymore. I just loved the Dead because the music, I mean, you know, if you were around in the 60s, I mean, there was just tons of experimentation going on. Everyone was listening to a wide variety of stuff. I mean, and a lot of the so-called rock bands were listening to like Indian music and jazz and, you know, all sorts of African music, and everybody was starting to listen to a wide variety of things and incorporated into their music. The Dead had this tribal feeling about them that I never heard in any other group at that time. There's a kind of a communal spirit in the music that was very appealing to me. And that was part of the zeitgeist, you know, of the late 60s too, of people really playing together and experimenting on stage, in whatever genres it was in. I mean, Paul Butterfield Band, their album East West, that album, I mean, that was like a long jam inspired by Greek music and Indian music. And Michael Bloomfield had been listening to all that stuff. That was just sort of natural. And of course, you know, Indian music had become very popular by that point because the Beatles were interested in it. And Ravi Shankar was sort of a pop star. So that was my first time hearing the Dead. And then I heard them later at least two more times when the theater became owned by Bill Graham and it was called the Fillmore East. And I heard them in multi-group billings and hard to remember who with whom or when. I really got into that Live Dead album. I thought that was fantastic. I listened to it incessantly. That tune Dark Star, I listened to it over and over and over again. As a college freshman in my dorm room, maybe I had a cassette of it. I don't remember anymore. I know I had the vinyl.
As the Dead progresses through the 70s, do you keep up with it or are you off on your own musical journey and it comes out of your consciousness?
Well, I kept up with it and Working Man's Dead and stuff like that. I liked it, but I'm going, gee, that's a real change. But that was part of the whole Back to the Earth movement. And so, you know, where hippies started moving to the country and growing organic vegetables, and, you know, we had food co-ops and stuff like that. It was all, you know, they were tuned into the spirit of the times. And, I mean, I liked all that stuff, but I didn't like it as much musically as their more exploratory things that they had done a little earlier. So I sort of stopped paying attention and, you know, was much more deeply involved in jazz and then world music, which didn't have a name, but starting around 1972, I sort of shut my mind against a lot of Western pop culture and started listening to music from all over the world, and trying to really get into the roots of music, of what it actually is from many different cultures, and sort of forming a musical map of the world in my head. And then I started learning a lot of other instruments as well. I started playing guitar and mandolin and flute, saxophone, African balafon, Chinese guzheng, which is their like a koto type instrument, all sorts of different ocarinas and flutes. And so it was sort of, you know, this musical journey inward and outward that I was involved in. And I was working in day jobs in factories. I mean, I had gone to school for a year and a half, dropped out, moved back to New York City for a year and a half. I played a lot on the street. That's when I started learning all these different instruments. It's a long life, I'm telling you. It's hard to encapsulate it.
No, I didn't realize you'd gone back to New York. I thought you stayed in Chicago after you were done with school there.
No, I moved back to New York. I got a gig playing in an off-Broadway show that was on a theater on in a theater on McDougal Street. That the show closed on opening night, leaving
successful.
Me high and dry. And it's a long story, but
so when did you go back to Chicago?
Well, I was in New York for a year and a half, and I came back to Chicago in June or July of 72.
And you were part of this whole, this scene that was going on. There's roots and folk and songwriting and jazz and blues, obviously, in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But you got, you know, Steve Goodman and Tom Paxton and John Prine and all these guys. What's the scene like there? And are there any, do you feel any connections like between that and the Dead?
I don't know about that. I mean, but I did a tour and record with Steve Goodman and John Prine and Tom Paxton, actually, and Bob Gibson. And I played on a lot of Flying Fish albums with and Rounder that were recorded in Chicago. It was starting around, you know, I was working in factories and did all sorts of weird day jobs and was teaching out of my apartment. And my career really started in earnest in Chicago in 76. And that's when I kind of exploded on the scene and started my own bands and, you know, started touring with these, with Steve and John. And then after I got through with that, I actually started a jazz quintet called No Bad Vibes, which I finally released an album of undiscovered tapes. I stole a page from the Dead's book. I call it From the Vaults.
There you go, man.
I have a series called From the Vaults, volumes 1 through 4.
And you were just holding on to these for all those years and then decided to do something with them?
I didn't know that they existed. So the recordings, I had forgotten I had done them. I forgot I wrote some of the tunes on the NBV album.
Wow.
It was recorded in 1980 in a studio here. And then some live stuff that I discovered on once I had my attic redone, discovered all these cassettes.
Yeah. Oh, what a feeling to find that.
Yeah, it was shocking. I mean, I remembered one tune that was a 14-minute long duet with tabla, with a fantastic musician named Willie Schwartz, who learned tabla from Zakir Hussain, basically.
Zakir Hussain's actually about to go back on the road with Mickey Hart for the first time in about 15 years.
Ah,
so they're putting Planet Drum back together with them and Giovanni and Sakura to do some shows.
Really? That, I heard that on the original tour. I was at the Vic Theater in Chicago, and Giovanni played his solo where he played rumba clave with one hand and a conga solo with the other. And I was there with Paul Wertico, actually, and wow. I fell out of my chair onto the floor when he did that.
I saw them a little later, I guess, in Chicago though, at the Park West. Same lineup and David Garibaldi on drums and just I want to go back to, we're talking about Prine and Prine, you go on the road with him. He's a singer songwriter, one of the masters, much like Robert Hunter in my book. But mm-hmm. my question would be playing with a songwriter like Prine or playing an improv based group like the Flecktones. Is one more satisfying, or do you find different kinds of joy by the way you approach it?
Well, I mean, the thing with Prine, I never thought I would do it for a year. I mean, I love playing good music with whoever, you know, and whatever style. I've played on, I don't know how many, 400 albums by now, maybe more. And so I'm used to like being a hired gun. I'll go in there and just try to play the best possible, most appropriate inside the music stuff on whatever instrument I'm hired to play. That's part of what I like doing. You know, that's another side of my personality. And also I played on several thousand commercial recording sessions in Chicago known as jingles, where, you know, you get there and they shove a piece of music in front of you. The clicks track starts, you put your headphones on and you play, you know? And so I'm a studio pro, you know, but I didn't think that the John thing would last for a year of touring. I mean, it was fantastic, but I didn't want to do it for a year. I was originally hired for 3 months, and you know, John was a genius, and I really loved him, and we had a great band. But I told people that to play the Prine gig, I had to forget 90% of what I knew and play the remaining 10% with 100% of my soul.
Love it. Love it.
And I loved it. And, you know, we were touring. I was playing multiple instruments. We toured with a B3 and a grand piano, and I would play them at a 90-degree angle from each other. And I also was playing harmonica, mandolin, penny whistle, steel drums after a while, because John said, I'd like you to play steel drums on this tune. I went, okay. I bought steel drums and I practiced them and I played it on that tune, and accordion, soprano sax. I don't even remember what else.
Wow. But, it's,
you know,
amazing to be able to be that versatile and fill that many roles for somebody. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, I you know, I was much more into learning instruments than I was as a keyboard player, like so many keyboard players were getting into like synths and stuff like that. And I never was interested in it. I was interested in acoustic sounds. So I say, oh, listen to this sound. Instead of like push a button on a keyboard or manipulate some waveforms, it was like, I want to play a flute. You know, Right. Listen to that. I want to feel what that feels like. And so I learned a lot about music from the inside out through the instruments. You know, the instruments are my teachers.
To learn all those different instruments, all those different fingerings, all those different positions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the piano, again, the guy presses the button, but he plays the same keys.
Yes.
While you were with the Flecktones, that your path starts to cross with the Dead, and on more than one occasion.
Yes.
And I know I believe the first time would be you all opened for the Jerry Band in 1990.
At the Greek Amphitheater in Berkeley.
Is that the first time you meet Garcia?
Yeah. And I had no idea that he had been a banjo player. You know, Baylor's the one who told me about that. And that, you know, I don't remember how he lost his finger, but that's why he couldn't continue to pick
his
banjo.
His brother accidentally chopped it off while they were cutting wood with an axe.
That's right. I knew it was some sort of, I thought it was construction, but it was okay. Yeah.
Chopping wood, and his brother Tiff took it off.
Damn. Well,
That kind of ended his banjo playing days. What do you remember about that? And what was your impressions of the music and Jerry as an improviser?
Oh, I mean, I was a huge fan of Jerry's playing. I mean, I loved it. I mean, to me, he was like one of the great voices of American music when he played guitar. It was like Louis Armstrong or something. It was something incredibly lyrical and heartfelt and soulful about his playing that made him stand out from every other guitar player. There are tons of, you know, great guitarists around in the late 60s. I mean, Eric Clapton and Hendrix and Jeff Beck and all sorts of other guys. There are tons of them. Terry Kath from Chicago was an unbelievable guitarist. But Jerry had a lyricism in his playing and a kind of a sweetness and a far-outness, too. I mean, of the exploratory stuff, too. I mean, right. it was multidimensional. And I remember when we opened for them, It blew my mind. I was like, wow, the 60s aren't dead. Like, because at that time, America had gone through the whole, you know, sort of squaring up of things with Ronald Reagan and the polyester generations and, you know, yuppies and all this other stuff. And so I'm looking at the Dead's fans. I'm going, wow, this feels like the late 60s. It's like these people never got out of this. There's like, I was unaware of that continuum, you know,
wow.
And it sort of blew me away. I was sort of amused on one level and fascinated on another level and sort of made me feel at home on another level.
Right on. That night that you guys, that first one with the Jerry Band, I don't know if you remember that was just a few nights after Brent Midland had passed away, the keyboard player from the Dead, and Jerry went out and still played.
Oh.
Because that was, I noticed the date of it, and I'm like, boy, that looks really close. It was 5 days after Brent, the keyboard player, had died.
Oh.
That Jerry was already out there, you know, playing. That's part of his grieving process, was doing what he does.
Yes. That's the most important thing for musicians, is to keep playing, man. You know, yeah. Music will carry you through a lot. And, yeah. That was 1990.
That was 90.
Really? First Flecktone tour.
And then, was that the very first Flecktone tour?
I think so. Yeah.
Wow. 90. And then in 91, you all opened for them on New Year's Eve.
Yes, it was Ola Tunji.
I was going to say, Ola Tunji was on that run, too. I got to play with him one time, and it was unbelievable. Here in St. Louis on a corporate kind of thing. It was just the best.
I first heard Ola Tunji at the New York World's Fair in 1965 at the Nigerian Pavilion.
He's young then.
Just gotten here. Right.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, look at that and listen to that. Wow. I never saw anything like that before.
Is that Drums of Passion at that point, or is that
it
is?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Man.
And you know that Coltrane played with Ola Tunji.
Mm-hmm.
That's another story. But so that was right after Bill Graham had died in that terrible helicopter accident.
That was their first New Year's Eve show without him.
Their last New Year's Eve show, I believe.
Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah.
And that was at the Oakland Coliseum, if I recall correctly, big circular building. And my friend Ken Ordine was hosting the live broadcast. We went down there and I had been playing with Ken for quite a while in Chicago doing commercials and also things for his radio show, which was called Word Jazz. That was on NPR, the local NPR station, and distributed. And that's another whole story. I recorded a lot of stuff with Ken.
We're going to talk about that, too. That's coming up, just so you know.
But I remember we were in that radio. It was a backstage room where Ken was doing the broadcast. And I brought Bela. I said, yeah, Bela, come on. You want to experience this. And so we sat there, and somehow Ken had us do some sort of free improvisation. I'm sure there's a tape of it somewhere. And Bela, we walked out and he said, Howard, what just happened? I said, it's Ken. I had no idea at that point. I guess Ken had told me that Jerry was such a big fan of Ken's. And Ken's basically sort of like freeform radio, but like way more than that. And, he was, we'll talk about it later if you want. But
yeah, I'm glad you brought him up because I did want to talk about that. Because in 91, which is just not too long after that New Year's Eve show, I guess, you and Tom Waits and Joe Craven and Grisman and Jerry recorded an album for Ken, the Devout Catalyst album. And is that how that all came about? I mean, you were already friends with Ken from the Chicago days. How did that group come together to do that album?
Well, Dan Healy, was engineering it, and it was just sort of a general discussion that Jerry really wanted to do this thing, and with the band with Dave, with Dave's quartet, with Jim Kerwin and Joe Craven, and maybe just the trio. I can't remember. I have an actual photograph of it downstairs that one of Ken's grandsons gave me. Ken insisted on bringing me along because I was, the person that really understood his thing. And he was a little afraid of just jumping into it with those guys because I could kind of read his mind and figure out what he really wanted. And I was very familiar with some of the lyrics that he wanted to do with those guys with different music than we had done with it. And so it was kind of I was an important ingredient in Ken's mind for this thing. And we did it at the Dead's studio and facility there in,
San Rafael.
San Rafael, thank you. Yeah. Right down the street from San Quentin.
yeah, on Front Street there, yeah.
Front Street, that's right, yes. And that was an experience meeting Dan. Dan was such a trip. Is he still with us?
Oh, yeah, he's still a trip. He actually came on the road with Darkstar and ran sound for us for a couple.
Oh, really?
We were between soundmen, this is years ago, and he came and got on our bus and did a couple tours with us and taught us more than we could have ever learned any other way.
Yeah, he's really kind of a genius.
Yeah, he really, really is.
That was a fantastic experience for me, just meeting him.
Yeah.
And then, of course, hanging out with Jerry and talking with him. And, it was fun doing the album. Jerry wasn't in the best shape when we were doing that. He didn't look good, and he wasn't dressing well, and you could just tell he was kind of, at loose ends.
Right.
Let's just put it that way. But he was brilliant and funny, and he had a very sardonic sense of humor, and and I enjoyed talking with them when we would hang out in between tunes. And he was incredibly smart guy.
Right. I read that Dennis McNally, the Dead's publicist, wrote about that album. He wrote that it contained no retakes, no touch-ups. It's voice meets fingers, words meet jazz. What was the process in making that happen? Each song has, I listened to it, and each song has its own musical vibe. So is Ken giving direction what he wants out of this musically, or are you guys just going for it?
To a certain extent, Ken would say, yeah, why don't you play kind of a groove that sounds like a snail walking through a garden. I mean, he would say things like that, you know, whatever it might be, you know, kind of a finger snapping thing, you know? And so someone would just start, because everybody there had the ability to do that kind of thing, to pick up on subtle verbal suggestions,
right,
that everyone kind of understood what Ken was about, you know? And it was probably my first time playing with David, I think so. I don't remember. Maybe I had met him before with the Flecktones. It's possible. So this was 92 or 93.
No, it was 91, I believe.
Oh, wow. So I was still in the Flecktones. Okay.
Yeah, it was 91. And at that time, David Garcia and Grisman are like right in the midst of a really prolific time. They're doing a ton of recording and they're making albums.
Yeah.
Was their chemistry evident to you? I mean, could you see that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And we did a live gig too. Jerry wasn't on the live gig. We did a live gig later at Bimbo's, that club in San Francisco.
I know it well.
And that was with Dan on sound. And that's where I first experienced in-ear monitors. They were some of the earliest pioneers in using them.
And it's right around that time, yeah.
And I told Bela about him. I said, hey, Bela, you know, you should check this out. You might be interested in it. Because the Flecktones, you know, one of the problems that we had with sound was that we didn't have a drummer doing physical drums. And so you didn't feel the drums in the same way. You know, when drums are coming through monitors, it's tricky. And we would talk about that a lot. And so Bela ended up doing in-ears for many years, mostly because of that. And it was something, you know, I was curious about it. And after a while, I didn't like them because it made me feel like a visitor from outer space. They were cool, but they cut me off from the feeling of being connected to the audience, made it feel like I was doing a recording session.
Right. I don't know if you're aware of this, but now they have them, and you got the mecca of in-ear monitors right there in Chicago with Santucci at Sensophonics. They have them now that actually have microphones in them that will pick up and have that separate volume control for them. So you can pick up the ambience of the room and not feel so studio isolated, you know?
I've heard about that. Yes.
It made a big difference for me when I changed to those.
Interesting.
Because as a drummer, I could hear my cymbals better that way because I'm picking them up. But hearing the room breathe and the crowd a little bit more and just not feeling so in the cans.
Yeah. It just made me too self-conscious in a way. I just felt removed, like a visitor from outer space, you know.
Right.
Hello, Earthlings.
you brought something up that I actually skipped over it because we were short on time, but I want to go back and ask it anyway about Future Man and the Flecktones. And I was going to ask, how much harder is it? I'm asking as a drummer to play. You kind of touched on it already. Instead of playing with a traditional drum set, to play with something like a drumitar.
Well, it does definitely have its challenges, and that's why the in-ear monitors actually help, because especially with the cymbals, you know, you turn your head, and high frequencies don't travel around corners very well. So depending on where you are in relation to monitor speakers, you're going to hear those cymbals really well, or you're not going to hear them well enough. And also the variation in dynamics levels are much more extreme. You can play a lot softer and a lot louder. So setting the volume in the monitors of those drums is also very tricky. So it was there were definitely some difficulties involved in that in on-stage performances. And, you know, when we were recording albums with headphones on, it was much easier, you know, because everything was right there.
anything physical, like taking a cue from a drummer or watching him set something up with a fill. A lot of that sometimes is a visual thing by seeing the movement of a drummer. And now you're not seeing that because the hand is hardly moving.
I agree. Yes, it's a whole different thing. But when you're playing with Bela, the banjo is like a drummer because mm-hmm. there's all these eighth notes happening a lot of the time. So if you're playing, like in a bluegrass band, the banjo player, everybody is part of the drums, you know, mm-hmm. just like in a Latin band, all the percussionists are part of one big drum set. So in a bluegrass band, you got the snare on the mandolin, and then you have like the guitar playing the chords, almost like the wash of the cymbals in a weird way. And the banjo is like a whole drum set. Of course, there's a bass player.
Bass player's kick drum.
And so the Bela's time, I mean, banjo players are obsessed with time. And if you watch most of them, they don't move very much. And they don't have much facial expression. Because that machine-like time has to be present at all times in their fingers doing those banjo rolls. In playing of the flectones, the drums are a composite of obviously the bass. Victor had also extremely percussive style a lot of the time, and so Victor and Bela were like big part of a drum set, and Roy was the other part, you know. So and he's really a kind of a genius and an inventor. And, you know, that was one of the reasons the Flectones had so much chemistry, is that all four of us were similar in terms of innovative approaches to our instruments, or in Roy's case, inventing his instrument.
Right.
And so we had a similar kind of spirit of exploration and discovery, and also of composition.
I remember seeing it, and now that you've told me when it started, it had to be an early tour, especially with the room you were in here in St. Louis. God, never seen anything like what Roy was playing at that time in a little basement bar called Cicero's.
Cicero's.
Yeah, man. I was at that show.
Those were great times.
I had never seen any music like, you know, I'm 19, 20, 21 at that point. I've never seen any music like that. And I've certainly never seen anybody doing what Roy is doing. No one had done it before, you know?
No. And he had to explain, he had a little rap that went along, you know, because people thought, like, where are the drums coming from? Like, is it a sequence? Are they playing with a click track? And I mean, no one understood what was going on.
Yeah.
And most people in the audience were mystified after the first tune or two. So, yeah. Cicero's.
Yeah, I remember that place.
Little basement place. Was it painted red and black?
It was black, yes. You're very good. With a low enough ceiling that you could put your drink on the I-beam above your head.
It was a great place.
Yeah, it was. I played there a million times with my original bands. Can't tell you how many bands I saw on their way up in that room, you know, back in the early 90s. When I was arranging this interview, you mentioned to one of my co-producers that you were at the last Grateful Dead show in Chicago. Yep. And you had a story you'd never told, but you would like to share. Am I on point with that?
Yeah. Well, that was one of those things, man. It's like, I'm trying to remember. Don't tell me of like, was it 93? No, what year was it? It was 95. Okay. Yeah. My memory is a little hazy on what year. So I had been out of the Flectones for 2 years by that point. I quit the Flectones the last week of 1992. And I had been touring with Kenny Loggins, and also a lot of stuff in Europe, and all sorts of other stuff, and my own bands. But I, you know, stayed close with Ken, and Ken said, "Howard, the Dead are coming to Soldier Field. Would you like to come with me?" I went, "Well, sure. You know, I'd love to hear, you know, those guys see Jerry again and blah, blah, blah. Dennis McNally will be there, whatever." I'm trying to remember all the things. And the Rick Danko and Levon Helm were opening, I believe.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yeah, the band.
Yeah, it was left. Whoever was left in the band at that point. Was Garth? I don't think Garth was there though.
You know, I don't remember, and I didn't go to those shows because they had just played in St. Louis the night before, and that's where I live. And I stopped. I was on tour and stopped at home and just didn't need to go there, not knowing that it would be the last shows. So I'm not exactly sure who was there.
But I had met Rick before, and I have a very great love for the band and a big soft spot in my heart for Rick Danko. May he rest in peace. And some of the tragedy that he went through when his son died. And they looked to all the worse for wear. I mean, yeah. Rick looked terrible. I mean, I think he had been doing whatever he was doing, and he didn't sound good. His voice sounded shot. Like, oh, shit, you know, somebody who I love so much, I was disappointed that he didn't sound better. And the dad got out there, and Jerry didn't look very good. And he was playing like through a fog, and he was playing like he was on the wrong frets some of the time. And I'm like, when he walked on stage, this is why I was married to my first wife at that point. And I turned to my wife, I said, he looks like death.
Just saw it, felt it.
I said that to her. There was something profoundly different. And I was very upset at the way he sounded. And then he started to play himself straight, whatever it was. And then as they went on, and the band sounded really good. And then they did So Many Roads. And he sounded so beautiful. The singing, the playing. That finished, and then they went into the light show. You know, I turned to my wife. I said, I want to go now because I want to remember that thing that I just heard. I said, I don't want to hear anything else. I said, that was his swan song. I mean, these are things I said, okay? I said, I want to leave. And then there was probably other stuff that happened. Maybe I said hi to him. I don't remember. We went backstage. I mean, I sort of remember like having conversations with their roadies about various things, but that's not important. I mean, everyone was super nice and, you know. But that's when I left. I said, I want to remember this. It was like a beautiful raga played. Yeah. It was fantastic. And, you know, I got the news. It was a few weeks later.
Let's see. And I called. Yeah, I guess August 9th, so 1 month.
Okay. What date was the concert?
The 9th, so July 9th.
July, okay.
And that was their last show.
And I called up David because at the time, David and I were in touch more, Grisman, and he was crying, and I consoled him. I tried to console him a little bit, you know, and he told me, you know, that Jerry was trying to kick it by himself, and he shouldn't have done that. You can't do that by yourself, you know. Oh dear. So that's that
memory. Thank you so much for sharing that. And you know what? You I'm glad you did that. I'm glad that for you personally, that's when you decided, hey, I need to go, because as that show went on, it went back down that way. And the encore they did that night originally, the first encore was Black Muddy River, another tender, like So Many Roads, a tender ballad tempo Jerry tune. And it went so not well that Phil called another tune and they played another one after it.
Ooh.
To end on a better note. So they finished, they played Box of Rain after that, which originally wasn't supposed to be. And they do one encore, they do one song.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just wasn't there. Hmm. And so Phil called another one. So I'm really happy for you that you did that. and that fed your soul when you were able to walk with that. And I really thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, it was a very strong feeling. I don't think about it often, so I'm glad that you brought it up. And so that was probably the last time that I was directly in touch with anyone from the dead that I can recall. Mm. And Ken told me some stuff afterwards too, about some things that might have been going through Jerry's mind at the time also. And I'm sure Jerry wrestled with, I know he wrestled with a lot of things, but also of being, you know, the center of this cult of adoration that he didn't encourage. I mean, it was just, it just happened. And I'm sure that it freaked him out.
That's part of it for sure. Then there's a business side of being the center of this machine that has over 50 people on payroll that are all relying on us to do what we do to keep them in their homes.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole lot to it. Mm. Before I let you go, I do this with all my guests, a quick lightning round. I'm just going to ask you some quick questions. A couple of them you already answered. Your first show, you already answered that, was 12/27/67. We figured that out. Studio recordings or live recordings when it comes to the Grateful Dead?
Well, I you know, at first I listened to studio recordings. I mean, but some of them were of live shows. So, right. I mean, I think the live recordings have much more. They're much better. I mean,
do you have a favorite Dead album?
Well, I'm the most influential one for me, as I told you, was Live Dead.
Live Dead. You know? That's actually a very common answer amongst my guests. Live Dead was a big one for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Here's a question none of my guests like, and I ask it anyway, and you're really not going to like it. That favorite non-Grateful Dead album, that one desert island album. If you're going to get stuck, what are you taking?
Besides one of my own, Pudum. that's a really tough question. I mean, I'd have to say something that I would constantly learn from. It's some John Coltrane album. I mean, A Love Supreme is the easiest thing to say, but it's probably not that one. I don't know.
You're not the first person to say Coltrane, though, either. That's which is tells you again the power of John. First job.
A musical job?
No, just your first job.
My first job was working in my dad's factory when I was, 14 or 15 years old. My dad had he made wrap toothpicks and paper bags and wash and dry pouches, and I was the shipping clerk. I drove a forklift truck and loaded and unloaded trucks.
That's awesome. I love it. That was what I was looking for when I said first job. Favorite color?
Blue.
Favorite venue to play?
Wow, that's a tough question. I've played thousands of them.
I know.
So, it's really weird, but this one venue is coming to my mind, and I love the Boulder Theater in Boulder, Colorado.
Cicero's Basement Bar.
some important things that have happened to me spiritually in places. I mean, boy, oh boy, that's a tough one. I really liked playing at the Capitol Theater in Porchester, New York.
Going to be there in May. It's one of my favorites.
That is a very special place.
Incredibly special, you know, and especially along those Grateful Dead reasons, you know, I mean, that was their home on the East Coast for a long time, you know.
I know, that's why I said that to you, but I had a very special feeling playing there of like this great rapport with the audience that it was just a mysterious thing I can't describe, and it was just this outpouring of warmth and love that I felt from the audience in that room.
Where am I? Favorite venue to play? Best city for a day off?
That's very funny you mentioned that, because I at one point I was thinking of writing a book called Musician's 20-Minute Tour Guide to the World's Great Cities.
It'd be a great book.
Best city for a day off. Someplace in Europe. I mean, I don't know. Rome, Paris. Yeah, I love wandering around European cities.
Yeah. Your first car.
Oh, boy. Volkswagen, a 1969 Volkswagen Squareback. Right.
your current car.
Well, I have a Mazda CX-5. Yeah.
And the book you are reading right now.
Well, actually, the book I'm writing right now.
There you go. Even better. Let's talk about the book you're writing right now.
It's about rhythmic breathing rudiments, where I have applied drum rudiments to harmonica playing.
Seriously?
Yeah. And it's going to be ready by this summer for this big harmonica convention I'm playing in Tulsa.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, I've I started thinking about this because my son was a drummer and I was going to his drum lessons and started realizing that you could translate right and left hand sticking patterns to blow and draw breathing patterns on the harmonica.
So you took the rudiments. Did you take the essential 13 or the essential 26 and work with those?
Well, I'm trying to maybe, like double stroke, triple stroke rolls, paradiddles and flam paradiddles and, the important ones, double paradiddles and the roughs and drag rudiments and stuff and apply them to breathing patterns on the harmonica.
Can you apply, and this is, we're getting geeky folks, but can you apply a flam to a breathing pattern since it's two different things happening at once?
Well, not quite at once. So it's right, like right, a quick in breath and an out breath. Doo-doom. You know, I'm trying not to play harmonica, but
that's a flam.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is going to be really cool. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, because at a certain point, I realized that underlying everything that harmonica players do, there's a rhythm of the breath patterns. So you could play eight notes, but those eight notes might be three blows in a row and then two draws and a bunch of alternating ones. So it might, the rhythm of your breath could be da, 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 da. You know, something like that, instead of taka 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 taka. You know,
this is going to be
the same
so
as
cool.
Drum strokes. Do 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 da do 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 da do do. You know, the bounce of the stick is a slide from one hole to the other with the same breath direction.
And this will be out for this. When is this festival? The end of this summer or the end of next year?
It's going to be second week of August, and I'm trying to get it all organized and write it down, and then of course have all the musical examples in finale. And with harmonica tablature, which I hate using usually, but in this case, it's like the blow and draw patterns and the rhythms that are generated by them are the most important thing.
So cool, man. Good luck with that. And please let me know when it's done, because I can't wait to see it. And thank you so much for taking so much time out of your day and talking with me. And I know my fans are going to really, really enjoy this. I know I have. I've learned a lot, and it's been a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah. Likewise, man.
Hopefully next time we come to Chicago, maybe you'll be in town. Come in and play a little Pigpen with us.
I would love to, really. And it's been a total pleasure, man. And so just be safe out there on the road and stay healthy and keep the faith.
Right on. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Howard Levy. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode, and I'd like to thank Howard Levy and Patrick Higgins one more time. I'd also like to thank my sponsors, Grateful Sweats, The Clean Store, and Beth Koritz at yourclarity.coach, and of course the Pantheon Podcast Network for bringing me into their family. You can check out their 70-plus music-related podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show and would like to support the cause, please consider a monthly Patreon subscription that offers some great bonus content every week, or you can show your love with a one-time contribution, and please remember that a portion of your contribution will go to the Rex Foundation. Get info about this and everything else related to the podcast at our website, www.themusicplaystheband.net. Any love is much appreciated as we try and keep the show rolling along. The Music Plays the Band is produced by myself and the production and songwriting team Brothers Lazaroff here in St. Louis, Missouri.
You can find out more about them at www.brotherslazaroff.com. The opening and segue music you are hearing are remixes of portions of DSO drum segments that are produced by my drumming partner Dino English. I'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 33. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and please stay vigilant. We're on the good side of things, and we want to stay there, so let's all do everything we need to make that happen. Thanks for being here.